Western society has been dominated by the printing press. And McLuhan sees in this the clue to almost everything that has happened. I mean, if men part their hair predominantly on the left, McLuhan attributes it to the Gutenberg galaxy. He's just dumbfounded at what he attributes to print. Now, McLuhan, that's it. The theme that excites me the most in McLuhan is his contention. It crops up again and again in his books that the Gutenberg galaxy has broken man into pieces in a very disastrous fashion. It's fragmented him. Something like a machine. It's turned him into a machine with movable and interchangeable parts. It has kept him from being a whole man and an integrated man. And in doing this, the Gutenberg galaxy has alienated man from himself, from others, the kind of thing that, where is he? Mr. Schilling.
Upstairs.
What's your first name?
Fred.
Yeah. We don't use last names. The kind of thing Fred was talking about this morning, where the difficulty we have in reaching one another, in touching one another, the sense of fear and of isolation that we so often encounter in interpersonal relations. McLuhan attributes this to the Gutenberg galaxy. And we're also alienated from the whole world, from the whole creation, from the universe. We're strangers in this world. It's not been created for us. Now, McLuhan also argues that electric technology is unifying man once again, enabling him to live, as he puts it, and I don't know what it means, mythically and in depth. Electric technology, TV and computers, this is enabling man once again to participate in the universe and in other people and to be at home and not an alien in the world. Now, my problem is that I think I agree with the first part, and I know I dissent from the second. I just do not see that television is doing all these marvelous things that McLuhan says. In fact, I see television as carrying to its extreme the sort of things that McLuhan sees as having begun with the Gutenberg galaxy. But at least we agree on this, though McLuhan and I seem to have gotten there from different points of view completely. This is what I'm going to try to wrestle out this morning. That modern man is tragically truncated. Man's conception of himself, and I think your conception of yourself, I would submit, unless you're a very rare individual. And this is McLuhan's main interest, how man thinks of himself, how he conceives and perceives himself. This is today, I think, so shallow and partial and one-sided and unrealistic that we are indeed aliens to ourselves. We really are puzzled by ourselves and not even at home with ourselves. And from this fundamental fact, there springs a whole Pandora's box full of modern ills, many of which McLuhan vividly describes. Last night, was just thumbing through the Gutenberg galaxy, checking things that I had checked earlier. I started from the back, went toward the front, and it doesn't matter with McLuhan's books. You can start anywhere. I just noted a whole bunch of things he talks about, things that have happened. Let me just read you some McLuhan. I should have flashing lights with all of this, trumpets, and well, you should be feeling one another's hair or something. The printed book has conferred on man dullness, not intellect and wit. One at last finds the dunces invested with uncivilizing powers of epic proportions. Supported by the Gutenberg technology, the power of the dunces to shape and befog the human intellect is unlimited. Readers have been befogged by content obsession and the practical benefits of applied knowledge. I don't know what that means, but it bothers me. He talks about print with its uniformity, repeatability, and limitless extent gives reincarnate life and fame to anything at all. The kind of limp life so conferred by dull heads upon dull themes formalistically penetrates all existence. I have a hunch I know what he means, but maybe I don't. Then he's quoting Leibniz, who he said detected the Gutenberg galaxy. Leibniz wrote back in 1680. Seems so modern. I even fear that after uselessly exhausting curiosity, without obtaining from our investigations any considerable gain for our happiness, people may be disgusted with the sciences, and a fatal despair may cause them to fall back into barbarism. To which result, that horrible mass of books which keeps on growing might contribute very much. One thing. What he calls the Cartesian technique of separation. Let me just say that everybody agrees today that Descartes is the formative influence in philosophy up until the 20th century. And all people calling themselves modern and avant-garde philosophers attack Descartes. But of course, they all start off with, almost all of them start off with Descartes' assumptions, so they wind up with Descartes' conclusions in a different form. He says, the Cartesian technique of separation ensured that all the neglected aspects of experience would be rolled back into the unconscious. The technique of separating out what you can put in a neat logical row and dealing with that and shoving everything else out of experience as not treatable, something that you can't handle, therefore in a sense not there. This strategy, says McLuhan, which grew from lineal specialism and separation of functions, created the world of dullness, bathos, and mock profundity. We've got a couple more. He says, all experience, after typography, is segmental and must be processed sequentially. Therefore, rich experience eludes the wretched mesh or sieve of our attention. We cannot find rich experience. It gets through. Nothing is rich. We look at everything and we say, so what? Because the screen of attention that we're using to sift things out lets everything exciting go through. It's like looking for gold on the top of your, they call these doohickeys that you wash the gold.
Gold pan, yeah.
It's like looking at the top. The gold's always down at the bottom. And then he said, homogeneous repetition, a la Gutenberg, leaves something to be desired in the way of a self. I don't know what this means, but how is one to reason with a person who feeds himself into a buzzsaw because the teeth are invisible? Such was the fate of the unified self in the age of print segmentation. But it is hard to believe in the reality of anybody who in any age could take seriously the Gutenberg assumptions when applied to the ordering of life. Of course, he says we do take them seriously.
There is a question.
Yeah.
If the printed word is supposed to be the dunce, influencing the dunces, why did he use the printed word?
Well, it's an embarrassing question. The answer is, many people point that, but he uses other techniques too. You know, he has records and tapes, and of course he uses the printed word badly. And he uses a mosaic pattern. His books do not follow sequentially. That's why you can begin anywhere. He just keeps talking about things, throws things out. And from this all, a pattern is supposed to emerge, like dots on the TV screen. Eventually, your whole self is lit up. But a lot of people point that out. I don't think it's a fair question, really. I mean, how else can you get across? In the age of print technology, you have to destroy print technology by using print. He says, philosophies from Descartes onward are diverse in the way in which a steam engine differs from a gas or diesel engine. And Bergson, who tried to end it all, is as mechanical as his enemy Descartes, although he preferred a kind of cosmic fuel for his system. He throws these names out here, and you don't know what he means exactly. He's getting name dropping, footnote dropping. Once grant the stripping and segmenting process for language and experience, and there is no possible stay, the roller coaster is off over the Cartesian, Lockean, Kantian course with all the built-in panic and angst that could be asked for. are quitting this experiment. Oh, he speaks of the unconscious as a direct creation of print technology, the ever-mounting slag heap of rejected awareness. You know, any Freudian, there's our Freudian, would have to be, you know, say, here's something, huh? Wouldn't you? Well, wouldn't you be sort of stimulated by this and want to inquire? Someone who calls the unconscious a creation of print technology and the slag heap of rejected awareness?
I wouldn't be able to accept it. Wait, Freudian
would. Not accept it at all?
Not really, no. See, according to Freudians, the unconscious is a remnant of all man's experience from the beginning of time that's been kept either genetically or in some other way transferred from mother to child in the womb.
But a lot of it is repressed awareness, isn't it?
Sure. That's why it's unconscious.
Yeah. All right, then the question is, why was it repressed? You think it's sex. McLuhan says it's print. Well, with this, we won't get into this. Maybe sometime we can have an argument about this. Take you on your ground where I'm totally incompetent. But neurosis was the product of print technology. There are some people who've argued, even psychologists, who've argued that the neurosis was invented in about the 18th or 19th century.
Or discovered, I'd say, not invented.
No, created.
Okay.
They argued it was created. There were no neuroses until the 19th century.
How come there are so, I see, they're saying all this witch burning and demon possession and mental hospitals were to cure things other than neuroses. Because, see, there were mental hospitals before.
Well,
and there were witch burnings before then. There were demon possession and all these things. Well, we'll talk about that later.
Those were real demons. Well, I'm just trying to stimulate you. Let me see. At most two more. Oh, yeah, I like this one. This is the chapter heading. The print made split between head and heart is the trauma which affects Europe from Machiavelli till the present. The split between head and heart is the trauma which affects Europe from Machiavelli till the present. It's made by print. And that split between head and heart is something that I see and bothers me. Oh, and then he says, this is the last one, the conflict goes on. The highly literate and individualist liberal mind, think of myself, is tormented by the pressure to become collectively oriented. I'm kind of in economics, I'm kind of a liberal economist in the old 19th century sense. I like John Stuart Mill. And all my socially conscious friends are telling me, stop applying the techniques of economic analysis to the demands of the poor people. And get in there and support them. I say, if I can't support them, I start analyzing. You know, I feel myself tormented by the pressure to become collectively oriented, to give up my point of view, and to go sort of sweeping along with buttons and signs and say, together into the future. It's we don't know what it is, but with our arms around one another and our eyes half closed, we march bravely forward. Well, now. McLuhan says, the literate liberal is convinced that all real values are private, personal, individual. Such is the message of mere literacy. Yet the new electric technology pressures him towards the need for total human interdependence. Hamlet, on the other hand, saw the advantages of corporate responsibility and awareness, with each man in a role, not at his private peephole or point of view. And then this phrase, is it not obvious that there are always enough moral problems without also taking a moral stand on technological grounds? See, and here I think I'm taking a moral stand on all this stuff, and McLuhan tells me, I just don't understand technology. Well, McLuhan is saying that we're in the grip of presuppositions that have held Western thought captive for three centuries or so. Created, he says, by the alphabet and the printing press as an extension of the alphabet. That's, man, that's what you call sweeping thesis, you know. Someone has said, I think it was MacDonald who says that compared to McLuhan, Toynbee is positively cautious, and Spengler merely pedantic. These presuppositions, whether or not fostered by print technology, and I'm certainly convinced that it had some print technology had something to do with it. McLuhan says these presuppositions have impoverished our actual life, that they are today the source of deep anxieties in Western culture, and that they are the result of a kind of hypnosis. So that all we need do is snap awake from our Gutenberg trance and live. This is what makes McLuhan so optimistic and cheerful. He thinks that we're wandering around in an anxiety-ridden, lonely fog, lost in the universe, and it's just because we've been hypnotized. And that's a beautifully optimistic thesis, because all you got to do is snap the person out of his hypnosis. And hypnosis, I don't know whether, do you know anything about this guy? He says that hypnosis, you know something about hypnosis? He asserts that hypnosis is the consequence of isolating a sense, one sense at a time. Is that true?
Well, it's a very definite concentrated form of concentration on one thing, like the voice of the person.
Yeah, okay.
Well, there you go. All
right, and he says that we have been so conditioned and trained to concentrate just on print and the printed word and to see everything else. Anyway, the example, in terms of this, for example, we're listening to somebody and the person explains, right, we say, I don't see it. And he goes, he's talking. We should say, I don't hear it. We say, I don't see it. And he says, I see. No, I hear. All right, I understand. He's got all kinds of other examples of how we've interpreted all the other senses in terms of the sense of sight. And this has induced in us hypnosis. Well, I ponder about these things and reflect. And last winter, I had an opportunity to go down to Thousand Oaks, California in January. And you get an opportunity to go to Thousand Oaks in January. You go. California Lutheran College is having a spiritual re-emphasis week. And this gave me an occasion to really think all these things through and decide what was good. Try to figure out for myself what I thought the plight of modern man was and what technology and science had to do with it. And I want to share some of these thoughts with you, and then let's get into a big argument about it. I think you will see that what I want to say now relates to McLuhan, but it may take a little while before you see precisely how it relates. And if you're puzzled as to whether I agree or disagree, I'm puzzled too. But this is the route that I found myself forced to take in trying to deal with the same phenomena that upset McLuhan. Fundamentally, the phenomena of man's alienation from himself and from others and from his world, something that I find really marked in our culture, in our time. The question that bothered me as I started off is why in the world colleges have spiritual re-emphasis weeks? Have you ever thought about this? Why don't they have material re-emphasis weeks? Spiritual re-emphasis week in January, material re-emphasis week in April. Why is it that the spiritual is so often in need of special nourishment? Public assistance, federal grants, propaganda. I don't think that question is so silly, nor the answer as obvious as you might think at first glance. If the spiritual, and I leave it undefined for the moment, if the spiritual deserves re-emphasis and special subsidy, then it's important, right? California Lutheran College forked out a goodly chunk of cash that could have gone for repainting the gymnasium, because they obviously thought the spiritual was important. But now, if something's important, it ought to be cultivated and pursued without artificial stimulation. Every December, CBS begins stimulating us to watch the Super Bowl. Don't miss the Super Bowl. But really, I think that's kind of wasted energy. There may be a few, I can't imagine anybody who really is going to watch the Super Bowl forgetting about it. The people who for whom it's important, they are there. I knew that that was an important spiritual event, and I was in front of my TV set participating. But it isn't that way with the important spiritual life. Somehow or the other, spiritual life needs arm twisting. Well, why is that? I suppose the answer that everybody gives, first of all, is that somehow or the other, people forget about spiritual values. Didn't you hear this so often? Spiritual values, you see, are important, and deep down in his heart, each one of us supposedly knows that spiritual values are important. But superficial concerns, or what we like to call the material side of life, these so engross our attention that we need to be reminded periodically and forcefully not to neglect spiritual matters. Now, there's something unconvincing about this explanation. There are other important concerns in our lives that we don't think about all the time. We tend to be submerged most of the time under the torrent of trivialities that carry along the stream of life. Things like health. The person who's always, health is important, vitally important. The person who's always thinking about it, we call a hypochondriac. Or friendship. Or insurance policies. They're important. Liability, fire, casualty, you know, life. Yet all these things, though, which are important, and which tend to get shoved aside in the daily press of affairs, they do seem to arise spontaneously to assert their importance in the right moment. When they've got to be considered, then they get considered. Because their importance is a kind of a fundamental presupposition. And fundamental presuppositions do assert themselves without benefit of special committees or life insurance re-emphasis weeks or anything like that. But the case is different with spiritual. Because whatever it is that we mean by spiritual values, they seem not to be threads in the fabric of daily weaving, nor, for most of us, do they seem to be part of the pattern from which we sew. Spiritual values, I'm suggesting now, are today, for most people, neither operational concerns, something that, you know, day by day in making decisions, shall I put more salt in the stew? They're not a part of operational concerns. We make operational decisions. We make our daily decisions without reference to spiritual values. Nor are they part of our fundamental presuppositions, at least not for most of us. Well, then, what are they? What is the domain of the spiritual? When a college has a spiritual re-emphasis week, what is it precisely that it's trying to re-emphasize? I think you've got to locate the spiritual before you can emphasize it. The rediscovery of the spiritual, it seemed to me as I was preparing for these lectures, the rediscovery of the spiritual was going to prove to be the perplexing challenge in whatever area of life or culture I wanted to examine. And it did seem to me, as I thought about art and ethics and politics and religion and science, that the spiritual, which was originally in all of them, and I still haven't defined the term, has indeed been leached out. Or at least that there are powerful forces at work in each of these areas of life and culture, tending very strongly to leach out the spiritual. That in each of these areas, the meaning and significance of what historically has been called the spiritual has been explicitly or, more importantly, implicitly denied in our time. Well, I better explain what I mean by spiritual. As a Lutheran, of course, I ought to tell you whether it's got a big S or a small S, because Lutherans have never been too much interested. They build on St. Paul here because he wasn't too much interested in spiritual life with a little s. The spiritual life that St. Paul is talking about has a capital S. It's life led by the Spirit of God. The spiritual person in the thought of Luther and St. Paul is not just the religious or the mystical or the non-materialistic person, the spiritual man. But he is the man who is led by the Spirit of God rather than by other spirits. If you look in the New Testament, you find that spirituality in and of itself is not good because there are all kinds of false spirits floating around. There are spiritual powers at work among God's rebel subjects. There's a spirit of slavery, the spirit of the world. These are all Pauline references. And in 1 Corinthians, 2nd chapter, Paul defines an unspiritual man simply as one who refuses what belongs to the Spirit of God. You might say he's unspiritual because he's experienced the spiritual renewal of the wrong kind. Now, my use of the word spiritual is related to that of Luther and Paul, but I'm spelling spiritual now with a small s. Because while I have a great interest in spiritual life with a capital S, it seems to me that what we really need to have spiritual life with a capital S in our time is a rediscovery of spiritual life with a small s. Frankly, if man has no spirit, or if it is one of the contentions of our time, that there is no such thing as the spirit of man, then I submit there is no place for the Spirit of God to get a hold of him. Now, I don't think that's heresy. I checked my Luther. I went to a couple of lexicons and looked things up here to see what Luther and then Paul meant by pneuma, the usual New Testament word for spirit. Luther, I find, once defined it as, this was Luther's definition of the human pneuma, or spirit. The highest and noblest part of man, which qualifies him to lay hold of incomprehensible, invisible, eternal things. In short, it is the house where faith and God's word are at home. Here, the spirit of man is a capacity, a power of comprehending, of grasping incomprehensible, invisible, eternal things. That's vague. But it's a capacity for grasping something that isn't easily manipulated, obviously. When St. Paul speaks of spirit, soul, and body, he is distinguishing aspects of man. And I think I have Thayer's authority for this, that what St. Paul means by spirit is the rational part of man, the power of perceiving and grasping, especially the power of perceiving and grasping the divine, the unconditioned, the element of depth in everything that is. At minimum, it is man's power of self-transcendence, his capacity to see that he is finite and yet not self-sufficient. This is what I take it Luther and Paul mean, and even if they don't, it's what I mean, by spirituality. Notice I'm getting completely away from, it has nothing to do with piety, it has nothing to do with church attendance or making the sign of the cross or any kind of religious rituals, or and nothing to do with preferring Bach to the Beatles. Spirituality is a capacity for seeing the element of depth in everything that is. And it seems to me the most important corollary of this is the capacity to see yourself as finite, limited, and yet not self-sufficient. The capacity to transcend yourself. And now, the nourishment of this capacity in man is the most important precondition for the renewal of the work of the Spirit with a capital S in our time. And now, it's not my aim, today or tomorrow or Wednesday, I'm not going to talk about the Holy Spirit. I'm taking very literally the task of spirit, small s, spiritual re-emphasis. I'm going to be trying to cultivate the Spirit in you, really by suggesting that somebody's trying to destroy it in you. And this morning, I wanted to talk about how certain people, whom there is no good name, scientismists would be a good one perhaps, the believers in the cult of scientism, I want to suggest how they are trying to destroy your spiritual capacity. It is, I think, profoundly true that our generation, our century, has systematically scraped off, sandpapered away the spiritual capacity of man. It has done so in the name of truth, but by denying finally it was possible to speak of truth at all. Well, now, let me shift. I've got about 15 minutes. I'm afraid it will be much. Maybe I ought to shut up and not. I ought to say what I want to say about science tomorrow. I'm afraid this has all been very vague and introductory. Maybe I should stop and let you say something, respond to all this. I feel guilty now. I'm talking like, the more notes I have in front of me, the more abstract and vague I guess. I should warn you about that. I've got reading something. Has what I have said so far prompted any questions, or does it call for any clarification, or does it convince you that tomorrow morning at 8:15 you'll sleep $5? This is the dullest part. Well, if not, you're not bursting to say it. Let me jump into this business of science. Because we've got a couple, as Carol said, our scientists are here now.
Right. I've got one question.
Yeah.
What you're suggesting is the spirit, the spiritual part of man is natural to start with, and then it's destroyed.
Yeah, being destroyed by our culture.
The spiritual aspect, the spiritual capacity of man is there when we're born innately.
I wouldn't say that. I don't want to get into this question innately. The thing is that for most people, through most of history, this capacity that I'm talking about is maybe the potentiality for having it has been there at birth, but it has to be cultivated.
In Christianity usually speaks as, accepting the direction of the Spirit.
From
the outside.
Capital S. Yeah. But now that spirit, the thing is, I would say that the spirit, capital S, hooks on to your spiritual capacity. If you have no spiritual capacity, then the Holy Spirit will come winging by and you will see no place to couple on.
That's the function of spirituality, if it isn't capital S.
To provide a place for the Spirit of God, if you're talking in theological terms now, to provide a place for the Spirit of God to latch on.
What's the function of it for a non?
It's his capacity to, well, it provides him with the ability to enter into the life of other people, to perceive the distinction between true and false, to become critical of his own opinions, entertain the concept of the infinite.
These are all Christian doctrines. To be able to see myself, in my failures, to be able to interpret myself, aren't they? I mean, they're not.
Well, I think Christianity encourages some of these things as virtues, and perhaps makes them more possible, but there certainly have been non-Christians with these capacities. And I would insist that this is a human capacity. And where it is lacking, men are somewhat less than human. And of course, I'm arguing that this is what the 20th century is doing to us. It is making us less than human. So that whether you're a humanist or a Christian, and I would hope you both, you've got to be concerned about the spiritual life. If you're a Christian and not a humanist, you have to say, man has to have within him the gripper fasteners on which the Holy Spirit can hook. And if you're a humanist, of course, you're interested in cultivating this capacity simply because it actualizes man's potentiality. It's what finally distinguishes him from other animals, lesser animals.
Well, I don't think we use a different word than a small s spirit.
Well, I could, but all words that I toyed with are subject to misinterpretation because they've been used by others for other purposes. The one that I would myself prefer is rationality. But this word has been so narrow to rationality for so many people has come to mean the economic application of means to ends. So that you will hear people will say, rationality always refers to the relationship between means and ends. There is no rational way of determining ends. Now that's a very, very narrow use of the word reason, rationality. But it is so popular that I'm afraid the use of rationality is subject to as many misinterpretations as the word spirituality. And fully, I figure, heck, seize the bull by the horns. Spirituality is a good word. And as you go back through the literature, even in the early part of this century, you find that the word spirit is being used in the sense in which I'm using it. And I think some words simply have to be recaptured. The late Paul Tillich, one of the most important things that he did was try to redeem words. There were words, he said, whose meaning had been destroyed for us, and there simply were no substitutes. Because Tillich believed that words were symbols, not just signs. Words were conveyed meanings that had been sort of gotten into them by a kind of cultural osmosis developed over centuries, or at least through a lot of communal conversation. And these words, consequently, were rich containers of meaning. Now, if somebody comes along and steals a word that's filled with rich connotations and applies it for a narrower purpose, you can't just let that word go. Because when you let that go and invent a new word, you lose all the meanings, that the connotations that have attached to the old word. I feel that way about spirituality.
It's a spirit with a small s. Is it a live word? Alive? Or is it, when it becomes a capital S, does it become alive?
It's alive without the capital S. I would argue that man, natural man, carnal man, has spiritual life with a small s. And here I have the mind of Paul, because he talks about men with spiritual life, small s, and they need that spiritual life corrected. They've got the wrong kind of spiritual life. Paul thinks of men as having this capacity for apprehending the things of the Spirit of God, but they often use it so as to miss the things of the Spirit of God.
Well, there is actually then a difference in the meaning of the two words, or one with a small and one with a capital.
Yeah, capital S means, when the New Testament talks about spiritual life, it is usually talking about the life that the Spirit of God creates.
In other words, God enters into this word.
Yes, yes. But not always. The New Testament also refers to man as having a spirit, a pneuma. That's part of it. And this is what I'm talking about, this capacity that is innate to man. Well, I hate to use the word innate because I don't think it's innate. I think it is something that's partially given by heredity and partially by environment. And it's in all of us because of our heredity, although I would have to say that undoubtedly with the children sufficiently retarded mentally, it is, if it's there at all, it's there in a very, very embryonic state. It is possible for man not to have the hereditary capacity to develop spirituality in this sense. But with all of us, I think, this hereditarily given capacity is being sandpapered away, eroded, sat on each time it tries to develop and grow by the presuppositions of our culture.
How about this example comes to my mind, and this is what we did to the Apache Indians when we put them on a reservation. And here's these rugged individuals with this great outdoor spirit, and then you just contain them with no place for them to do this. And is this about the same type of thing you're talking about? Because of that type of environment, we just sort of put them down?
I don't know. It's a dangerous analogy. Might
well,
be.
It could be.
It might be a fitting analogy.
I'm not sure. I'm just trying to grasp you here, and I just wonder.
We destroyed the spirit of the Indian, and that's why the Christian gospel is so hard to read.
Well, if the analogy makes sense to you, entertain it. I see dangers in it. Are you generally, Paul, you want to say?
I was thinking that
the concept of small s spirit versus the concept of large s spirit might be thought as the potential for small s to become large s, the power to become. The small s spirit is our power to become.
Well,
it's a gift which all men hold or have.
I would accept that. No, I wouldn't either. I wouldn't like that. I don't like that way of putting it, because I would want to insist, because I'm such a gung-ho Lutheran, that there is a crucial step in here which man does not become. There's a point at which man can nurture his small s spiritual capacities on his own. He is not dead in this sense. He really needs other people to help, but this is something that man is capable of. But to make the leap from small s to big s, there needs to be something given from outside.
Agreed. But this is the quality in man which gives him the power to reflect. The power to become an image, the power to become, it's the potential upon which God can act.
Yeah, it is the potential upon which God can act.
Right. I'm sorry I didn't think of the last words first, but I very often find myself.
Okay, yeah. And I think now, maybe this, see, every man has this potential to some degree upon which God can act. This I believe. But some men have such little stubby potential, and other men have such enormous potential that, here maybe be the man with a stubby potential, the Spirit of God grasps him and transforms his stubby little spiritual life into stubby little capital S spiritual life, and so he goes out and he puts shirts on Balinese women. You know, that's the... His missionaries go out there. They're bringing the message of God and reconciliation of the world. And what are they going to do? Put shirts on the women. Wow. Then there's a St. Francis who goes out and preaches to the birds. Maybe that's a bad one. Maybe you think he's a nut. But I think you think that St. Francis was a nut for preaching to the birds. That suggests that your spiritual life, small s, got fractured. You know, there are Christians who are little people, and there are Christians who are big people, and it isn't a matter of how much brain power you got. It's a matter of something else. You take a narrowly circumscribed individual who has chiseled away almost all of himself, or had it chiseled away over 30 years of life, and now you convert him, and now he becomes a narrow-minded Christian. You take a large-spirited person, and you convert him, and he becomes a large-spirited Christian. I further believe, and I don't know how I would work this out to your life. I'm sure I'd get in trouble if I tried to, but if you think of it, Holy Spirit is looking for a way to get a hold of a man's small-ass spirit and transform it. And golly, sometimes it's a tough hunt. You may never find it because there's nothing there, almost nothing there.
Do you feel that a large spirit then can become small by confinement?
Yes. Yeah.
By erosion.
By erosion.
Don't you feel that this is what is happening in a communist society and also the capitalist society?
Well, as long as you added the capitalist society too, yeah. Well, I think it's happening in modern technological society. Mm-hmm. That it is not so much a function of the economic system as of that which underlies the economic system. In industrial, technological society. And the key and the cornerstone of all of that is science. And what I wanted to talk about now is the misunderstanding of science that I think has done more than any other single thing to sandpaper away, erode away man's spiritual capacity. The misunderstanding of science has convinced us of certain things at a very deep level, has ground into us certain presuppositions that gradually grind away our spiritual capacity. It is, although people will reject it when it's put as flatly as I'm going to put it now, it turns out when you push them, this is what they believe. And they believe it on the basis of the conditioning by scientism, that fundamentally they are no different from rocks. And this view, I want to try to show how it developed and why it developed, and maybe in the process convince some of you of it. That would be good. Convince you that you are just like rocks, sort of bringing to consciousness that which is unconscious, or slightly below the level of consciousness, then try to show you the internal inconsistency involved in this, and most importantly, when I talk about science, how this refutes the scientific enterprise itself, how this belief, nurtured by science, is inconsistent with the presuppositions upon which science itself has developed and proceeds. But I am not attacking science. I'm going to come back to this tomorrow, which we can do. I do not want to be understood as launching an attack on science. In fact, I want to defend science against scientism, which eventually will destroy science if it is not corrected. This misunderstanding of science is destructive. Because it is destructive of man's spiritual capacity, is also destructive of science, because science is one of the finest fruits of man's spiritual capacity.